So a little note before we get started with this episode, which we actually recorded on the 11th of April. It's been at least a week and a half from us recording to you actually listening to this, so clearly a few things have happened. The one main thing is that Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, and Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, were issued with fines for their involvement in Partygate. So obviously we don't touch on that during the course of this episode, but we feel that most of our comments are still relevant, and that's why we are still releasing this episode. We hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, how many offshore trusts do you have in your name?
Oh, that's a good question that I wish the answer were something other than I don't know. I don't think I have any, although I don't know, maybe I have been left something. That would be nice, wouldn't it? A lovely surprise. Maybe a trust fund in the Bahamas.
Could be, yeah. I mean, I'd have thought like zero would have been the most likely answer, but you don't seem that confident about it.
Well, no, I just don't think so. But I also don't really know. I don't know how I would find out if I have one.
I think you'd have to write to all of the authorities in the various, you know, UK foreign territories.
Ugh, everyone.
Possibly, yeah.
I don't bugger that.
I should know how these sort of things work. I used to vaguely write about it when I was covering money laundering, but
yeah, you did. You should have been better at your job, shouldn't you?
I mean, I'm sure many of my employers would agree with you on that front.
Yeah. How are you, Jimmy?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Jazza?
Yeah, not too bad. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk about politics, social issues, and current events. This week, as ever, three topics being injected directly into your brain skull.
Yeah, and the first of those topics, if you've not already picked it up, is around Rishi Sunak, our Chancellor, who's been accused, not always directly, but of some financial misdoings.
Has he? I think he's just been accused of being a rich person who tries to pay as little tax as possible, and because that's what they do, and also technically being a resident of the US until October 2021, which was a shock for everybody on Downing Street.
Do you think it was a shock?
It's meant to reference the point, Jimmy, that he lives at 11 Downing Street. Famous address that someone in his job lives at. And to pretend that he isn't a resident there seems quite droll.
Does he not live at 10 Downing Street? Because that's the smaller flat. Have they not done the usual?
Oh, no, don't
thing?
Go. No, don't be... keep this podcast accessible. Don't be a nerd.
I don't actually know if that's true. Apparently, he's recently, literally this week, moved out of Downing Street, though, whichever number he allegedly resides at, and he's moved to a luxury West London pad in the journalistic jargon.
Wow, that seems so much unlike the Sunaks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, they're usually so down to earth.
So the Sunaks, as Jazz has called them, haven't been accused of any illegality of any sort, but they have been accused of minimising their tax liability, to put it as politely as possible.
No illegality, plenty of immorality.
That's one way of putting it, unless you read Guido Fawkes, in which case you'll say that there's nothing immoral about moving your money offshore in order to not pay the full amount of tax. I can't remember whether it's avoid or evade is the illegal one, so I'm going to just avoid and evade using either term.
I thought Guido Fawkes' whole shtick was fuck people in power. How do you bend yourself backwards to say, oh no, it's okay to not pay any... Oh god, I hate everyone. I'm not in a good mood today, Jimmy. This does not bode well for the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't entirely. Speaking of things that are not going to put you in a good mood, Jazza, do you want to talk a little bit about what's happening in the French elections?
So France has a quite gripping presidential election style. They looked at America and went, hey, you know what? Let's do that twice. So they have two rounds of a presidential election. The first one where they whittle down to the top two, and then the top two then go forward into a head-to-head battle to the death, which actually I'd be down for that. the traditional two centrist, centre-left, centre-right parties, the socialists, who aren't very socialist. Well, actually, for France, they're not very socialist, but they're the socialists and Les Républicains, who are the centre-right party, have been absolutely decimated in the first round, getting, I think, a combined amount of votes of 5%, which is, I don't think I need to tell you, listener, very embarrassing. The top three candidates were Mélenchon, who I think is a communist.
Far left type guy.
Yeah, super left. Like, makes Jeremy Corbyn look moderate.
I think he wants to pull out of NATO, so maybe he's different from Jeremy
every
Corbyn.
Every other Tom, Dick, Hill, Harry wants to pull out of NATO in France. They're an absolute nightmare. In second place, and therefore going through to the final round, is an old favourite, Marine Le Pen, who is, we've talked about before in these parts, because she was also in the final round in 2017. Her party was formerly Le Front National.
Yes.
But you're going to have so much fun, listener, by the way, hearing me over-exaggerate French pronunciations.
I'm enjoying it so far.
It's one of my favourite things. The Front National, but I can't remember what they are now. Mouvement Populaire or something like that? What are they? You look it up.
I'll do some Googling in the background.
Marine Le Pen, from previous hits of Let's Leave the European Union, Let's Ban Muslims from Everything, and Fuck the Poor, or something. I don't know.
I actually think that's...
She's pretty populist, isn't she? She's not
I think it's more Macron who's on the Fuck the Poor side of things.
Yeah, she's very protectionist. She's kind of like if the Renew Party, who are ex-Brexit, got their shit together and had like a charismatic woman. That's Marine Le Pen. And then in
first place,
I'm not
sure that's a good comparison. It's National Rally or the Rassemblement National.
Rassemblement National. And then exactement. And then in first place, this podcast a mess. In first place, so far with about 30% of the vote, compared to Marine Le Pen's, I think 23% of the vote, is Emmanuel Macron, everybody's favourite. Somewhat attractive, short French president.
I'm not sure French president really narrows the field down a great deal.
It doesn't. Sarkozy famously had to stand on blocks behind podiums when he did joint press conferences with other leaders. Very funny. Mm. But Emmanuel Macron was a bit of a... He's somehow both an outsider, but the ultimate insider as well. He's basically a bureaucrat who worked for a previous French president and then was like, I've got some charisma. He started his own party and then won the presidency. Whoops. And he will be, if he wins in 2 weeks when the second round of the presidential election happens, where Macron goes up against Le Pen, he will be the first French president since the year 2000 to get re-elected.
That is very exciting, and I've let you run on at great detail, far longer than we should do in an intro, so I'm going to have to cut you off there, Jazza.
Oh, sorry, just the background.
We'll talk about the implications of all that exciting background in the second segment of the podcast. Mm-hmm. For the final segment, I've managed to convince Jazza to discuss this for all that's happening over the last 2 weeks, or that's happened over the last 2 weeks, where various Labour politicians have been asked, can a woman have a penis? And...
Can I just answer that really, really quickly?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Moving on.
I think most people would say no, which is why this...
Cool. That's okay. Some people don't know.
Which is why this
question... And haven't thought about it. It's weird to think about other people's genitals at length, isn't it? Unless you're intending on doing the dirty.
Yeah, I would say so. But this disparity between the answer you gave and the answer most people would give has put Labour politicians in something of a bind. And it has highlighted the whole controversy over various mm-hmm. issues of trans inclusion in single-sex sports and toilets and women's refuges and that sort of thing.
And it's about time Jazza got pissed off on the podcast again.
Well, I think we're going to gradually up the temperature here, starting with a bit of, tax things and then French elections. And we're going to end on this question of can a woman have a penis?
And I'm already exhausted.
Jazz's head will explode. But in the meantime, let's play some music, talk about the Patreon accounts, and get on with the main podcast.
Okay.
If you've been enjoying listening to the Right Dishonourable podcast, you might be interested to know that there is a selection of bonus episodes available only for patrons. To access them, you just need to go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable, where you'll see all the sign-up details. Recent topics of conversation have included the preparations for the next general election, Jazz's favourite pronoun, and the plan to pardon men who are convicted of consensual homosexual activity. We'd also like to thank our existing patrons, Eternal Elf, Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, Jer Carney, Ilona Diomkina, John O, Marlene, Matt, Michael Costa, Nick Webb, Seb Kales, and Theo.
You want me to start, do you?
No. Jimmy, how do you feel about the general approach of holding a politician accountable for their spouse's financial arrangement?
I think in this instance it's fair enough. I think there are probably some instances where it's not really relevant, but in this case I think people have been, you know, playing this card. I've noticed James Cleverly said something about we shouldn't criticize politicians' wives or husbands are not elected officials. They're not running for office. They're not in the political fray, as it were, and therefore they're beyond criticism. But I think that the essence of a marriage...
Jesus Christ, I weren't expecting this.
The essence of a marriage is you pool assets. Like, you know, it's a concept of shared ownership. That's why that when you go to court...
Have you ever heard of a prenuptial agreement? That's the most shockingly old-fashioned thing that I think you've ever said on this podcast, and there's a long list.
I don't think it is. I think that, you know, the essence of, like, you combine assets, you live in the same household, you are a single unit as far as the law is concerned. Yes, prenuptial agreements do exist. Possibly the Sunaks have one. In fact, I think it's reasonably likely, given how rich...
Reasonably likely. Sharta Murthy, who is Rishi Sunak's wife, is worth something like $11 billion.
Yeah, she's worth an incredible amount of money. She's the daughter of the founder of Infosys, which is an Indian IT company. She owns like a fraction of a percentage of shares in Infosys, which is still worth an incredible amount of money.
Sorry, 11 million may have been an 11 billion may have been an exaggeration, but her stake, she has a 0.91% stake,
yes,
in Infosys. Wouldn't it be lovely to just like be really rich and give your children like a less than a percentage share and then they become a multimillionaire? Her stake in Infosys is worth £500 million.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Like, that's so much money.
That's probably not, you know, the sum total of her assets. I think she is a billionaire. I think I'm right in saying that. But she's incredibly rich. It kind of doesn't really matter if she's a billionaire exactly. I think if you're a politician who is setting the rules around tax, and then, and you know, as part of a government that occasionally does criticize people for, you know, not paying the top amount of tax, not particularly this government, I guess, but you know, the whole Jimmy Carr debacle, whoever was prime minister at the time, I think came out and criticized him for having, you know, tax minimization arrangements.
Tax minimization arrangements is the biggest euphemism.
I can't remember whether it's avoid or evade, and I've committed to not looking it up during the course of this podcast.
Mm-hmm. I think avoid is legal, evade is illegal.
Okay, I'm not prepared to use that language in case it's wrong.
Right, okay, sue me then, Rishi fucking Sunak. Come at me, bro.
But I think, you know, if you're the one setting the tax rules, and if you've in various ways committed to increasing tax to, you know, pay for money to pay off COVID debts effectively, then, yeah, I think it is. If your wife is then minimizing her tax contributions through non-dom status, which is already quite controversial anyway. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. That's fair criticism. Like, I get the idea that the spouses of government ministers and prime ministers and what have you do have private lives, and they have separate lives. Not everything in their life is fair game, but some of it is, and this is one of the things that is fair game, I would say.
The non-dom status thing, I think, is the one that's the biggest kind of like flag for the whole setup, because she, like you said, and like we said, she's doing nothing illegal. Neither of them are doing anything illegal. But when there was a first criticism about her non-domicile status, which basically means that she only pays, she doesn't pay any tax on her income outside of the United Kingdom, or her income earned outside of the United Kingdom, which obviously applies to stuff like her Infosys shares, she released a statement that essentially implied that she had to have a non-dom status because she was an Indian citizen. You can't have dual nationality if you're Indian. But non-dom status is something that you have to actively ask to be. Like, you have to apply to be a non-dom. And so she has decided, even though clearly her permanent residency is here, she goes holidaying every now and again. Her kids are educated here. Her husband is literally, arguably, the second most powerful person in the fucking country. But yeah, she's like, no, the UK is not my permanent residency. But I believe that she's like, oh, but it's legal, and so it's totally fine. But I think that it shows the difference in perspective of super rich people and what they are allowed to get away with, and a normal person who's like, no, but this is objectively nuts. Like, you obviously, your main place of residence is the UK, and you're clearly only doing this for tax reasons so that you get more money.
I mean, is that thing she said about Indian citizenship having to be singular, is that true?
Yes, you can only have a single nationality if you're Indian.
So for her, presumably she would qualify for UK citizenship if she wanted it, but she can't that without giving up Indian citizenship.
Yeah, exactly. But you can be an Indian citizen who resides in the UK permanently.
So she could be a resident rather than a non-dom resident.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that
makes more sense, doesn't it?
It
really
does. It does make sense, yeah.
The person who lives next to the Prime Minister.
I suppose it's also just an example of how the further you get up the the financial tree, there's more carve outs and special exemptions for rich people than there are poor people.
I wonder how that comes to be. I mean, somebody should really research this and come up with like at least a theory or something.
Yeah. One thing I do find interesting about the look of all these stories, I don't know if you've seen some of the recent photo ops that Rishi Sunak has done, like one of him trying to...
Oh, the one with him in IKEA.
Was it in IKEA? Was that...
No, in a Kia. Sorry, I understand how that can be a confusing set of turn of... The car,
IKEA. Yeah. Trying to fill up...
Trying to fill up IKEA. And yeah. Then he tried to pay for it and he didn't know how to use a card machine. Can you imagine like they just live in a fucking I in the grand scheme of things, actually I quite like him. I'm sure he'd be a lovely person to hang out with. He's a big nerd. I disagree with the way he does almost everything, but hello, he's a conservative, surprise. But can you imagine, he's just in a completely different plane of existence to a normal human being, that he doesn't know how to use a fucking card machine. Now, maybe this is hyperbole, right? And he was just having like a bad day with the card machine. Sometimes it doesn't work for you, you know?
I mean, but sometimes you do know how to use a contactless payment machine.
And it doesn't work properly.
It doesn't work properly, or they have some weird like system that you're unfamiliar with. There are, you know, there's possibilities out there.
Sure. But it's great that people said he doesn't know how to use a card machine, and everyone, yeah, that checks. That's probably right.
I mean, I guess if you're the Chancellor, how often do you have to actually physically pay for anything? Like, obviously, you'll pay for big purchases like buying a house or something, but you're not going to run down to the corner shop to get some milk, are you? That's
run down to the corner shop to buy a house.
Well, they are very cheap these days. So, so yeah, it's not. I mean, the way this has been framed is that Rishi Sunak was a year or so ago a golden boy who was destined to be the next prime minister, and the narrative has turned completely on its head that he's totally done for now and he'll never be prime minister. Do you buy that as a theory?
I mean, do you remember in like January when we were saying that Boris Johnson was going to like leave in weeks? I think that people are going to. I think people price this in. I hate that, but I think people price this in. And people will broadly forget. And I think also we at least try and kid ourselves that we're not meant to really care about how rich or otherwise a politician is, as long as they do a good job. And I think that that narrative actually works quite well in the UK. Like, I've heard it a lot on commentary and in phone-in programs and stuff like that, where we shouldn't really care. But he literally creates the rules that allow his wife to pay less tax.
I mean, he didn't create that rule, to be fair.
No, sure.
He manages the system of rules that includes that. Yeah, some people were saying
and had just put up taxes on like a load of people, and it just sits really badly. It doesn't seem fair. It just doesn't seem fair.
I mean, the thing is, if you've got to the stage where you're a government minister, by definition, you're not living a very normal life. Not just because your work is unusual, but because you'll almost certainly be an MP. So you're already on 80k salary, which is, you know, a ton of money, as we've gone into before. You get additional salary for being a government minister. I think I read somewhere he's on about 150k when you include the MP salary and the Chancellor salary.
That's all right, isn't it?
It's pretty good. Yeah, I mean, you'd think he could afford to pay a bit of tax, given that's the amount he's earning. One thing he did do was that he donated 100 grand to his former school in Winchester. It's a private school.
Oh, I bet they really needed it.
It's to fund bursaries for children who can't afford to pay to attend. So it is for a worthy cause, Jazza.
I hate it.
Not impressed with that. Should we talk a little bit?
Just give more money to state schools. You literally have the power to make things better for state schools and maybe help millions of people, Rishi. Rather than, like, what, they'll take on 10 a year?
Okay, Jazz has become a socialist.
I really have. I've said many a time that I'm being radicalised by this Conservative government.
One last thing about Rishi Sunak before we move on. Is this business about him having a green card, which is a residency permit for the US that you have to live in the US for a while to qualify for. I can't remember how many years.
And you have to, it's basically intended to be a route to citizenship for people, is one of the reasons that it exists, but many people don't use it for that.
Yeah, once you have one, I don't think it can be revoked, except, I mean, potentially.
They expire after 10 years.
Oh, do they? Okay. But you can renew them quite easily, can't you? So it is, as far as I understand, it's effectively a permanent residency.
I am unsure, Jimmy.
You're unsure. But So I think he got this while he was working in the US, and he just kept it up until, God, I can't remember.
October 2021, which was less than 6 months ago.
He gave it up when he travelled over to America as his first trip there as a UK government minister. And then I read somewhere that he had a chat to the kind of diplomatic or customs authorities there, and they decided it would be best if he gave it up at that point. Is the official line.
As an official resident of the United Kingdom and the second most powerful person in the fucking country. You'd think that that made the most sense, wouldn't you?
I don't know. I find it hard to get excited about this green card thing. Like,
yeah, I think it's the less interesting bit. But I think it's also fun to shit on Rishi, isn't it? what I think probably happened is because he became Chancellor in late 2019, right?
Wasn't it early 2020?
Because it was when...
I think it was early 2020 that he became Chancellor.
When did Saj leave?
I feel like Saj left after the general election, so...
No, I'm pretty sure it was before. Wasn't it before?
So Rishi Sunak became Chancellor on the 13th of February 2020.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, like, he may... It matters less if you're, like, just a an MP. He probably thought,
he was a minister before that. He was chief secretary to the treasury before.
Yeah,
that.
But no one really cares about that. he just kind of like it's a nice thing to have, something to brag about when you're having dinner parties.
Yeah,
I guess. And then
you have to pay for it. You have to file tax returns to keep your green card.
Yeah, but he doesn't do them. Somebody else does it for them, doesn't he?
I was more focused.
He's never seen a tax return in his fucking life.
I mean, as I understand it, Jazzy, you don't file your tax returns either. You have.
Yeah, I do.
You do?
Yeah. Where did you get that impression from?
You tell me you gave them to your dad to sort it out for you.
No, he looks over them to make sure that I'm not committing fraud. But Jimmy, I don't pay someone to do them, is the point.
Do you not?
Although usually you should pay someone to do them, to be fair. To make sure you're not doing fraud, you know?
Fair enough, but I wasn't really focusing on the admin side of things. I was focused on the fact he had to pay money, presumably like a reasonable amount of money, I would guess, in order to retain his green card. So
the things people will do for bragging rights. And then we had a Panindem Lovato for 2 years. And to be fair, it's probably not at the top of your list to continue to cancel the green card, you know?
Probably. I don't know if you have to cancel it or if it just lapses. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not that bothered if the Chancellor of the UK has a residency elsewhere. I don't think it's that big a deal, do you? You think it does? I mean, you're the citizen of the world, cosmopolitan, rootless type. Surely you should, you know.
Stuck in Stratford.
Surely you should back dual citizenship government ministers. Surely that's okay. You don't think it is?
Jimmy, what an interesting framing.
That's all we're arguing about, right? Like, if he was a dual, like, French-British citizen or Irish-British citizen or...
But it's not a citizenship, it's a residency. Like, he's meant to live abroad. He's meant to live in the US. That's why a green card exists. This is more of an issue for, like...
If it was citizenship, you wouldn't have a problem. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, actually.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I think so.
That surprises me.
Because then it's an identity thing. And you know I love identity.
So essentially your argument, if I'm reading between the lines here, is that because you think it's a bit of a put-on, it's just something he's kept for bragging rights. That's why...
I don't actually think he kept it for bragging rights, to be clear. That was to be funny. Yeah, I don't know. I think it is the less interesting one because it doesn't really matter as much. A lot of people seem to be implying that he's not really properly invested in the UK. They have houses in California and stuff. Like, they live the life, fancy lifestyle, blah, blah, blah.
Well, she studied in California.
Studied in California.
Oh, right. Yeah, because he's got a degree from Stanford or something.
Yeah, I think they were both Rhodes Scholars. I think. And that's how they met. Oh, how romantic. Yeah, I think it's the less interesting of the two. But people are framing it as he's not really that invested in the future of the UK because he doesn't see his future here. I imagine as soon as he stops being like a politician, they'll move back to California.
Have they ever lived in California, like on a permanent level?
Oh, well, yeah, as students.
Beyond as students.
And I assume so because they have a residency there.
I guess so, and he did spend time working in the US, but he's been back in the UK for a while.
And he had a green card, so point...
Yeah, he must have lived there for a while, of course. Yeah. Okay, well, you know, if Boris Johnson could sack Rishi Sunak and, you know, maybe he'll
Oh, God, is Rishi Sunak?
We really should do more preparation for this podcast.
No, never.
Come up with better puns.
Rishi Sunak?
I mean, you're a loss to the Sun's headline writing capabilities, Jazza.
Oh no, you mean I'm not going to be employed by the Sun? Can you imagine? My dreams dashed.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Okay, should we speak about somebody else's dreams that might be dashed? Either Emmanuel Macron, you know, winning a second term as president of France, or Marine Le Pen, who, I mean, I suppose her dreams won't be dashed because she'll probably just take another run at it next time. But somebody's going to be disappointed.
That does seem to be like the vibe of the Le Pens. To be fair,
persistent.
They keep on running again and again and again. So in 2017, when they had the last presidential election, it was the same two in the runoffs, and Macron quite easily trounced Le Pen because people rallied around. And what tends to happen in the second round of the French presidential elections is who do we not want to get in? It happened with... I can't remember his name. I think his name is Marine as well, or Marion or something. Le Pen, her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Jean-Marie Le Pen.
He also shockingly got into the second round, I think it was in 2000, against, I believe it was Jacques Chirac.
Are you just naming French politicians at this point?
I am. Mitterrand, Napoleon was also there.
Napoleon the 24th.
Yeah, exactly. Jean-Marie Le Pen was in the final round with Jacques Chirac and also got trounced because people were like, we can't have the National Front. As a president, you can't have the National Front as the president. Marine Le Pen, flash forward to now, has managed to not only rebrand Le Front National as Rassemblement, but she's also managed to soften the image of her father's former party quite effectively. She's kicked out a lot of anti-Semites. No word on the anti-Muslims, though, so that's fun. And has managed to kind of like frame herself as a savior of French culture. Great, love that, because the French, if anything, love their culture. She's very anti-immigration, is anti-NATO, has historically been quite pro-Putin. And so the political establishment are quite freaked out at the possibility of her winning. She got 23% in the first round. Macron got 30. Polls are a little bit all over the place.
There's one that puts them in touching distance of each other for the second round.
I've seen everything from 6 to 1 point between them.
Hmm.
And that is really fucking close. People do not like Emmanuel Macron. He is seen as... not being sensitive to the rising cost of living crisis within France. The Gilets Jaunes protesters came about, I think, in the first year of his presidency. And it's all a bit up in the air. And I think that Le Pen could win.
She could win, certainly.
Shall I predict that she'll win?
I wouldn't like bet on her winning as a certainty, but there's definitely those kind of margins. There's definitely a chance of her winning.
The thing is, Macron hasn't really done any campaigning. He said, "I'm so sorry. Je suis désolé. je suis très occupé with the war.
Avec la guerre.
Avec la guerre. Je voudrais un croissant. No. He."
I thought you spoke French, Jazz.
I do. I'm
rapidly
do.
Running out.
I do. I'm being silly. But he was like, sorry, I'm really busy being a statesman. Look at me being a statesman. That will make me really popular. And so didn't partake in any of the campaigning up to the first round. Now he's gone into like big campaign mode and is actually leaving Paris. Imagine.
I have to say, my only touching point with the French election up until the point you said let's cover it on the podcast, after which I did tons of research.
Can you stop making us look bad? Jesus Christ,
for some reason I keep doing it and yet the Patreon numbers keep going up. It's just no one can explain that. But
don't reinforce this behavior, listeners.
But there were two photo shoots of Macron that were shared around British Twitter, British political Twitter, to much merriment, I have to say. One of them was of Emmanuel Macron coming into the office wearing a hoodie, doing a sort of Zelensky cosplay.
Oh, I was thinking it's a bit Rishi Sunak, but yes, a bit Zelensky too, right?
I mean, there was a shoot of Rishi Sunak wearing a hoodie years ago now. But yes, I think what he was trying to invoke, because I think it was it had some sort of military insignia on it, so I think he was going for the Zelensky vibe. And there was another shot or series of photos of him having just finished a call with President Putin and holding his head in his hands and looking very distraught and upset about things. Both of these photo shoots were hilarious, and I do not understand why he decided to put them out. Like,
yeah, I bizarre. Don't understand the head. I've never understood the head in the hands thing. As like a, why, like you want to, surely you want it to look like the call went well. Otherwise, it implies you're bad at your job, mate.
It kind of just looks like sort of accompanying shots for a music video shoot about a bad breakup or something, where, you
right,
know,
yeah,
the guy's
it's
just
very
looking
album cover.
Super distraught and, like, sad and, you know, take me back, please.
Mm-hmm. He is an odd one. He's also done some weird... what's the opposite of... what's the good version of a dog whistle? Like, pandering to... like Frenchiness, so he really subtly Frenchiness. He changed the color of the French flag really subtly. So for I think 20 years or so, the French flag, the blue on the French flag has been the same color as the blue on the European Union flag.
Right. Okay.
And he changed it back to a slightly different blue.
Darker or lighter?
It's lighter, I believe.
Okay.
Or darker. It's one of the two.
So yes was the answer.
Yeah.
And the red stays the same?
Yeah, the red and white stay the same.
I mean...
because they changed it so that, like, there was a... because otherwise, when you have the European flag and the French flag together, the blue being slightly off is quite jarring.
Right, okay.
One could argue. And yeah. You know the French, they love colours.
I mean, criticizing people for gesture politics is a bit of a cliche, but, you know, it seems appropriate in this instance, I would say.
Yeah. I don't know. So some French people I know, the French people I know are very split down the middle. I had a couple of conversations today, and I've heard from people who are terrified of Le Pen and people who are like, fuck Macron, get Le Pen in. Wouldn't it be nice to have a lady? Yes, but wouldn't it be nice if that lady weren't racist? Allegedly.
So what's the analogue here is roughly that Marine Le Pen is kind of like Nigel Farage in terms of social temperament.
Kind of,
maybe with a little bit more Jeremy Corbyn economics mixed in there. Is that fair to say?
That's why I was like, it's Renew. Because
I don't think Renew is like that at all. Are you thinking of the Reform Party?
Sorry, the other one that is something. I mean, what Brexit Party is now?
Oh my God! Like, when you initially said that, I just thought you were making a terrible comparison. I didn't realise you'd got the name wrong.
Sorry, it's quite Brexit Party. So it's like socially conservative, fiscally liberal.
But Nigel Farage is quite Thatcherite in his outlook, so he's different from that. Then
he is, but Nigel Farage is a cunt. She wants to do a load of stuff that is very, very kind of like protectionist and nationalistic. So she has suggestions in the manifesto of prioritizing French people in jobs. Taking away the right to French citizenship if you are born in France. And also, which is the, I remember debating this back in like 2006 when I was doing an A-level in French, banning the hijab in public places in France, which doesn't mean you can't walk around with a headscarf on outside. It means not wearing it in, actually, no, I think it does mean that because it's already banned. I need to do more research.
So they have this policy of, I'm going to mispronounce this, but is it laïcité?
Laïcité, yeah.
Which means that in quite a lot of contexts, you can't have religious symbols on your person.
Visible.
In public positions of various sorts. There was also that, I don't know what the outcome of this was, but wasn't there a movement to ban the burkini in France? So this is a slightly more modest swimsuit for women.
God. It's just a part of French culture that I think it's really difficult for us to understand as Brits, because why are you telling somebody how to fucking dress? Like, it just seems really out there and stupid. Like, if I want to wear a Christian pendant, or I want to wear like a Star of David or something, let me wear it.
Well, I think in France,
but it's a part of it's their culture.
In France, Catholicism has been quite aggressively confronted over the years. I feel like Protestantism in England has kind of been allowed to wane through sheer apathy, basically.
Yeah, so the Archbishop of Canterbury is now like critical of the government on the daily, so you know, quite like him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that will precipitate a crackdown against anarchic Protestants. Maybe the Boris Johnson will turn against them.
Mm-hmm. The Protestant vote. Is that? Yeah. I'm sure it's a thing. Do you have any predictions, Jimmy?
No.
Okay. Because there's a lot of fear-mongering around Le Pen becoming the president of France. Do you think they're warranted in any way? Don't just say no again. Elaborate this time, please.
So, the policy that really stuck out to me, actually, was Marine Le Pen's pledge to not withdraw France from NATO, but to take it out of NATO's command structures in various ways. So reduce the amount of collaboration that France does with other NATO members.
Just what we need with a resurgent Russia.
Yeah, I mean, that is really bonkers. And Britain and France are the two military powers in Western Europe. Obviously, Germany is now...
Soon to
be joined by Germany, to be fair. But it's going to be, realistically, a couple of years before Germany gets
Turkey
up to speed.
Turkey as well, Turkey.
I did say Western Europe. Okay. And
All right.
Turkey's arguably not even in Europe, but...
It's famously the bridge between East and West, Jimmy.
And, you know, to be fair, Turkey is looking a more reliable ally since the Ukraine crisis. But, if France decides that it's not gonna play ball in terms of how the rest of the West wants to confront Russia, that's a serious problem.
It is a serious problem. I wonder what the photo opportunity is going to be when President, it's just President with an E on the end.
Indeed.
Because it'll be feminine.
Yeah.
I wonder what the photo op after she gets off the phone with Mr. Putin is going to be like.
I mean, I will say in a very narrow sense that, I mean, France is less exposed to Russian energy markets than, say, Germany is, but...
they love nuclear.
They do love a bit of nuclear. They love it so much they'll build nuclear facilities in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, the whole confrontation with Putin... even though I think it's a good thing for reasons discussed on previous podcasts, it is raising the cost of living for ordinary people. I mean, it's pushing up energy prices. It's, the war itself has caused disruption to various global supply chains, which increases costs. In some ways, the pro-working person thing to do is to allow Putin to win the war in some way, like the way NATO's behaved in a way that those costs have eventually transferred to us. Like, we're all bearing the brunt of this ultimately. In a way, what she said, you know, if she's saying, like, you know, I mean, she's backtracked from her like friendliness to Putin, hasn't she? But if you're gonna withdraw from NATO, that's not exactly a, you know, an anti-Putin
yeah, and you're trying
move,
to get
right?
over 50% of the vote in France.
You know, I'm just saying there's another side to this. If I was living below the breadline
I bet you'd vote Le Pen. If you were in France now, you'd vote Le Pen. It would be the same as Brexit. I feel like I don't have any connection to NATO. Like, I never see them. Like, what do they do? What do they even do? What's the point? And NATO's becoming too good. More.
I mean, I feel very differently about NATO, and France is a great warmongering nation. Obviously, loves a bit of NATO. Very, very keen on it.
Love a bit of NATO. Spread it on your bread.
I think previously they've been a bit annoyed that the language of command is English rather than French, but that's That's kind of the standard French contribution to any international body is to complain about the language it's being held in.
Is to make sure that French is an official language of whatever body that is. Yeah. OTAN is NATO in French.
I mean, I don't...
I think is better than NATO. OTAN.
It sounds a bit more muscular, I think. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but...
It sounds like a Conan villain or something.
Yeah. I mean, Macron does seem like an arrogant dickhead to me, but...
That wouldn't
preclude me voting for him, I just want to say.
If you think that you can start a political party from scratch, name it after yourself, and then run for president, and then you win... I think that if anybody has the right to be a little bit arrogant, it's probably Macron.
Yeah,
but he has got terrible teeth.
They don't seem that bad as it goes.
He's got gaps. There's gaps. Lots of gaps.
I mean, some people find that endearing. You know, winning quality, I would say. What are Macron's policies? We've not actually discussed that at all.
People are also unsure because he hasn't really done any campaigning yet.
Cool. Okay. Well, maybe I'll wait to see what policies
he wants
to pursue.
Hey, do you want me to continue leading Europe?
Is he leading Europe? Surely that's Olaf Scholz now.
I think Macron still is because he's been around longer. It feels like he's more established in European circles.
Yeah. And I think it would be a very bad thing for Marine Le Pen to win this election at this time. So, you know, just for from an outsider's perspective, I'm not in favour of her winning. But maybe I would feel differently if I was French living in France.
You know. Si vous étiez...
Context is key.
I've forgotten how to do the subjunctive. Never mind. What was the last thing you wanted to talk about?
You know what the last thing I wanted to talk about was...
Mm-hmm. No, go on, please.
How closely have you been following this story about Labour's difficulties with the question of whether women can have penises or not?
I've disengaged from it as much as possible because I find the topic of trans people being battered around like a topic of like casual conversation and as a way to make politicians feel awkward is really distasteful. And I choose not to engage with it. For my own well-being.
Okay, well, I'm about to detract from your well-being for the next 10 minutes.
Thank you for that. I'm really looking forward to it. Please go on.
I've heard, not just you, but quite a couple of journalists online have effectively taken the same tack you have and said that, you know, the week where these questions were being asked of different Labour politicians, can a woman have a penis? Everyone said, oh, this is very crude and reductive. And I mean, I don't know if anyone used the word offensive, but I'm sure people did find it offensive in various ways. And they said, you know, various people said, I don't want to phrase the debate in this way. I think Angela Rayner, the deputy Labour leader, said we should be moving this debate away from social media and like containing it somewhere else. It's not entirely clear where else that would be. We obviously differ on the issue at hand, but. As a journalist, I've got to say, crude, straight to the point questions are often the best questions because they're often the most revealing about where not just a politician, but any interviewee lies. Whereas the more elaborate and convoluted a question is, the more scope they have to dodge out of the way without you necessarily noticing.
Sure.
And I think, you know, this question in a does cut straight to the point of something, which is that, you know, from... In very straightforward terms, are trans women women? Do you consider them to be women? Is another way of phrasing that question. But
And I find it very depressing that we are still having that conversation. I understand your view that we like it is a part of our zeitgeist. It's a conversation that deserves to be had. And sure, fine. But I made my mind up about trans people yonks ago, and I'd see how hard it is for mates of mine to have this conversation about the validity of who they are debated by people who have never met them, who won't even have conversations with trans people. There will be full conversations on newscasts about trans people and they won't include a single trans person, and I find that absolutely insane. And I've talked before about the similarities with how gay men were treated in the 80s and the 90s that resulted in stuff like Section 28, which meant that people weren't allowed to mention gay people around young people at all. It meant I didn't have any effective sexual health education that was relevant to me. And it, all of the same arguments of think of the children, they're grooming children, or they're trying to, like, think of the irreparable damage, think of, this is child abuse. It's all the same arguments just being repeated again with people who are in my community. And and forgive me, Jimmy, I find it really depressing to see history repeat itself, and to repeat itself with some of the most vulnerable people in society, where suicide rates are through the roof, where they are more likely to be in poverty, they're more likely to be homeless. People swanning around saying that trans people are trying to go into bathrooms and go into single sex spaces and try to abuse people, or they're coming for people's gold medals or whatever. Just let them bloody exist. There, go on, sorry. But do women have penises? Sometimes, yeah.
Well, I think that the way men and women are used as words, I don't think that's true. I think that for most people, the way they understand the word man is...
I'm sure, but when people are saying that, they are excluding trans women from the classification of women. I don't think that that is correct. I don't think that that is the right thing to do. Trans women are a type of woman, and therefore come under the women umbrella. Some trans women are going to have willies, but in the words of Emily Thornberry, I'm not going around looking up people's fucking skirts, am I?
So that was
And frankly, it's quite rude to do that, generally, to talk about somebody's genitalia, especially when they ain't fucking there.
Right, but in terms of how language is actually used, because language is not dictated by any minority group, whether it be, you know...
It isn't, and I'm sure most people don't think about what I have just said. Like, most people in the UK almost definitely don't think about the nuances of what I just said. But that is why it is so frustrating, and it can be so damaging. Like, that's why it is a really difficult thing to engage with, is because of the fact that the journalists know what they're doing. They think that it's, oh, look at this politician squirm. But actually, you're talking about a really vulnerable population. And people I like. And so I wish they didn't do it.
So I totally get your view, and I can see why you're like upset by the debate.
You can say some things now. I'll allow it. I will sit down and I will be quiet.
No, you're allowed to be like angry, and you're allowed to disagree with things I'm saying. I just think that there's definitely a disconnect between how people who are very media literate and people who, I mean, I know I didn't go to university, but people who are very sort of university educated and policymakers talk and think about these issues, and I think a far higher proportion of them would say trans women are women can have penises. I think the way those words are used in general discourse, I think most people basically think you're a man or a woman depending on what genitalia you have, in a very crude way, and I think that's why the question cuts through. And I think the reason that some Labour politicians have not been able to provide a comfortable answer to that is because it's difficult for them to appeal to two different constituencies, one being the more progressive graduate educated class and the other being their more, I mean, work, you know, this is slightly stereotypical, but a more working class traditional constituency.
But I think most, like, as you said, less people with less formal education, maybe more working class people. I've had these conversations with family members who didn't even finish secondary school. And they get it. Like, it's not like you have to read a blooming feminist manifesto in order to understand that trans women are women and they're not just a man, and that you shouldn't be calling them by he or him or using their old name. Like, as soon as you frame it as something like respect, something about like respecting somebody, people seem to get it. But there is so little exposure to trans people because they are always going to be a tiny minority, even less than my minority. Like, it's something like less than 1% of the population at the moment identify as trans, and so most people are never going to come into personal contact with them. And so you're not going to really think, of course you're not going to be thinking about the nuances of whether what gender can have, what genitalia and all of those kinds of things. But as soon as they meet somebody, as long as they're not JK Rowling, they can say, oh, you're you may be unconventional, or you may be completely passing and you identify as a woman, but you were assigned a guy at birth, for example. All right, let's get on with it. Like most of the time, with people who haven't engaged with this question very much, it is actually quite a simple conversation to have.
See, I think you're glossing over various things in that little spiel there. I mean, for one thing, I'm sure that J.K. Rowling would not really have a problem addressing people by preferred pronouns and treating them with respect, whether they were trans or whatever else. And I think that having read the essay that she put out several years ago about trans debate and single-sex spaces, and particularly in relation to women's refuges, I think it's repeatedly misrepresented what she said. Like, it for me, having... I always get the impression that when other people speak about it, are critical of her, we have not read the same essay. Like, it just the way it's like described doesn't tally. I mean, I've obviously not read it for a while, so I'm not remembering exactly. But when I read it at the time, I'm like, this isn't similar to how it's being described by people who are critical of it. And I think
her... just because like I remember we talked about this on the podcast.
Yeah.
Most of the people who are critical of it haven't read it. That is the way.
Yeah.
As the Mandalorian definitely says, that is the way. But there are plenty of things that J.K. Rowling has said and done that are explicitly transphobic, in my opinion, and I'm happy to call her that.
Okay, but I agree with you. I think most people are happy to muck along with whoever they find in life. I think that's a general rule. But I think that when you say it's the correct view that trans women are women, I mean, I think that really...
I didn't say that it's the correct view. You said it's my view.
Right. Okay. But either way, it's not an... I don't think it's...
I don't have the authority, Jimmy. Unfortunately, I write no dictionaries.
But the discussion of what words mean. In 50 years' time, it might be totally uncontroversial to say that women have penises. But right now, it is controversial, I think, because that word has been being redefined in the last 10 years since I've been following politics. I think that word has shifted in meaning.
But it's the fact that... Sorry, I'm back on... Let me just... There I am, back on the soapbox. So the fact that this quite... I understand your the positive that you said about kind of like that clear-cut answer. Like I also appreciate that as kind of like an interview technique. But the fact that it was I see that question as quite childish, and even children don't ask those questions. But I find it as really reductive and puerile. And the fact that that was happening, I know that these days are made up, but around Trans Visibility Day, it was being asked of politicians when the government decided not to ban conversion therapy for everybody, but for trans people. I know trans people who are like genuinely quite scared to be in the UK and to live here now. And the fact that this stupid conversation about whether or not women can have willies and whether or not like trans people can play in sports and stuff like that, it just makes me very depressed.
So beyond the actual, the theoreticals of this conversation, what do you think it means for Labour? Because actually... I'm generally of the view, I'm of a more trans exclusionary view than you. You're more trans inclusionary, put it that way. But I actually don't think this stuff will probably matter for Labour a great deal when it comes to election day. And I notice that a lot of people who are more on my side of the debate think that this is going to be like a time bomb for Labour that will explode near the general election, will really hurt their chances. But I just don't really see that it has the salience, generally speaking, among people who don't care about politics or don't follow politics that much.
I've seen this kind of stuff have salience, though, and you see it with a lot of the way that the Conservatives especially are talking about trans folks, excluding them from the conversion therapy ban. for example.
So the conversion therapy ban, just to stop you on that point.
Right.
So the Tories have, I mean, there was a weird U-turn thing where they went back and forth, but they're now going to ban conversion therapy for gay people. So you're not going to be able to...
Gay and bi people.
Gay and bi people. So you're not be able to go to, in my head, these things are always camps rather than, you know, counselling sessions, but you go somewhere.
It's more often than not, it's religiously based, and they'll offer to say, pray the gay away.
Pray the gay away in that phrase. But the conversion therapy for trans people, the reasoning they've given is that they've said therapists should still have the option to explore other, you know, other options with you know, gender dysphoric people, for instance, and to not necessarily go for some of the more medically intrusive therapies and that kind of thing. But is that an explanation you buy, or you don't think there's anything in that?
That's... I guess it makes sense if you don't understand how difficult it is to get gender recognition in this country, and to get to the point where you are where you get gender therapy, especially via the NHS. Of course, you can go privately. It takes many years for you to go through the process where you then, in order to change your gender, have to be put in front of a panel. Those people have never met you. They see your case and they decide whether or not that you can identify, and your documents can say the same gender as the one that you identify with. Like, as if people flip-flop if convenience or on a whim as to what their identity is going to be. Of course, there are some people who identify as gender fluid and stuff like that, but that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about gender affirming stuff. That, and I don't want to be overly use hyperbole here, but it really does save people's lives. People themselves because of gender dysphoria.
Yeah, but the argument wasn't that they were going to ban gender affirming therapy. The argument was that they were going to ban, I suppose, gender disaffirming therapy, or therapy that was open to the possibility feelings might change.
It's conversion therapy. It's exactly the same as what gay and bi people go through when they go through this. Can you imagine somebody saying me, but you could be straight? It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same as that. And excluding trans people from that is nothing but... I really worry that it's going to be a framing that the Conservative use in whatever next election it is, because it's a minority that so few people have exposure to, and because it's something that has clearly defined lines, and it works for parents who are scared about, oh, but my kid's a tomboy. Your tomboy kid is not going to be transed by us banning conversion therapy.
I don't think that was the fear, but I'm just trying to... that's the explanation that the government has given, and certainly
I don't buy it.
You don't buy
it. It is exactly the same argument that you make for... It's exactly the same argument that they used to make for gay and bi people who were going through conversion therapy. Well, they should have the option to change. We can't. It's who we are.
But to finish up then, you said just before I actually diverted you down
before
that...
Before you make me cry!
Before I diverted you down that path. You said you think this might have some salience when it comes to the general election in probably 2024. You think this might actually cause some problems for Labour?
I don't think it necessarily will cause some problems. I don't really care, honestly, on this topic. I don't really care about Labour. I care about, it sounds like I'm virtue signalling, but I really don't care about, what party says what. But the fact that this is where some kind of, of the battleground seem to be being drawn, all I think about is the consequences that this is going to have for friends of mine who are trans. That's all I worry about. I genuinely don't care whether this will be a problem for one part or the other, because there'll be more important things.
But presumably, given the Tory party's stance and its general positioning on these things, the Labour Party is a much better hope for those people you care about, right?
It is, yeah. And Labour have their own kind of trans-exclusionary members as well. Like, it's not a clear-cut party line thing. It's more of a, it's, it tends to be more of a generational thing than anything. It'll, I was about to say, it'll be interesting where the lines end up being drawn and who's in which camp. I won't be interested in it at all.
What do you mean by that?
I can't engage with it. You've heard me go through this. This is like, yes, I've had soapbox moments, but this genuinely really does quite scare me. I really, really worry about, like, close friends of mine and how this is going to affect them. That's like, it makes me anxious. And I wish we'd learned more from the past, and I wish that people, there's something quite curious about the UK and how much mainstream media is really, how the anti-trans or trans-exclusionary-ness bleeds over into lots of kind of like academic circles, and it bleeds over into kind of like mainstream media. The BBC famously has had a lot of people with conflicting views in high places, and in particular shows and editorials and stuff like that. It's all over the print media as well, regardless as to what affiliation it has in terms of the political leaning. We have quite, like, there's not many other places, I don't think, or at least when I look at the US and Europe, there's not many places that have that almost everywhere. And that's what kind of, like, worries me, because everybody can find a trans exclusionary person who looks like them.
What do you mean by that?
There's plenty of people who are trans exclusionary, but there aren't enough trans people to humanize them, or at least not enough visible trans people. And I really worry, because at the moment, being a public trans person is one of the hard in the UK not a gig that, why would you want that? Like, at the moment, can you imagine, like, going around and people asking you about your, like, whether or not you got a willy, and whether or not you should be allowed to play sport. Like, it's.
I don't think that's what's being asked. I think it's whether, you know, Leah Thomas, I think this is who you're referencing, the swimmer, should be allowed to compete against other women. Sorry. Yeah, well, other women in the all-women's,
yeah, other women.
Yeah, sports championship. I think, I mean, those sort of questions, it's not to say that Leah Thomas can't play sport. It's about which category she's allowed to play in, which is different, I would say.
But I'm sure we'll get to go into trans people in sports later.
I've been avoiding it because I know how heated it gets. But I mean, as you say, you know, if you look at the polling on a lot of these things, people are in day-to-day life are quite accepting of trans people by and large. If you look at YouGov stuff on this, I mean, there's certain areas such as sports and, as I said, women's refuges, where the question is a bit more fraught and you can ask the question in slightly different ways. But I mean, that's a question to me. A lot of it's about linguistics apart from anything else. There are some practical implications there, but I think even if I was fervently on your side on all these questions, I wouldn't feel as negatively about it as you do. I think the prospects for, you know, trans inclusionary advocates, I think, are probably better than you say they are. Is my interpretation.
I hope so.
All right. Well, I've tortured Jezza enough for the last 20 minutes. So let's wrap this up. Where can they find you on social media, Jezza?
Jezza John on all social media. And you know what? I'm going to plug the other podcast. I do another podcast called the Queer Movie Podcast. It's about queer movies in the format of a podcast. I do it with Rowan Ellis, who I'm riding on her social media coattails. it's a good podcast. Go and find that.
It's better researched and produced and organized than this one, I think it's fair to say.
and makes money.
Wow.
Not a lot, but it does make money.
All right, you can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter. That's it. All right.
Cool. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.